Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit VoiceAmericaHealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed in the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed by life's difficulties or a traumatic experience? You are not alone. Welcome to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving with Lisa Ferrance. Today, you'll hear from professionals and everyday people who understand the impact of life's challenges and the personal growth and newfound meaning that can come from the healing journey. Listen, pay it forward, and your life could change too. Now, here is your host, Lisa Ferrance.
Welcome. I'm Lisa Ferrance, and this is Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. I'm so glad that you've joined us today. We'll be talking with Dr. Janet Sasson-Edgett about the impact that bullying has on children and what we can do as families, as communities, and really as a whole society to fully commit ourselves to facing this serious and insidious problem head on and how we can make a difference that counts. Let me tell you a little bit about Janet. She is a psychologist practicing near Philadelphia, a prolific author, having just published her 6th book. She's a workshop leader and a speaker with 25 years of experience helping children, teenagers, and their families. And I can tell you, based on her books, that she is a talented clinician with an absolute gift for working creatively and effectively with kids who have no interest in being in therapy, and that is no small feat. And she also speaks frequently to parents, giving them compassionate, non-shaming, and practical advice. She gives many training seminars for mental health professionals. She's taught at several universities. And I really want to put a plug in for her latest book, The Last Boys Picked, Helping Boys Who Don't Play Sports Survive Bullies and Boyhood. This really is a sensational book. I loved it. It's beautifully written. It is chock full of valuable information. Just a wonderful read. As soon as you all finish listening to this program, go out and buy this book, The Last Boys Picked, Helping Boys Who Don't Play Sports Survive Bullies and Boyhood. Janet, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Lisa. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. Great. So I think the way that where it makes sense to begin is to ask you to define for our listening audience what we mean by bullying and maybe some of the subtler verbal, physical, and emotional ways in which teens can bully others and can experience being bullied.
Sure. I think generally bullying is understood to be a situation where someone uses their physical strength or their social strength or influence to intimidate another person or humiliate them or devalue the person's sense of themselves or to make them anxious or fearful or embarrassed or self-conscious or anxious to go to school. That's generally what bullying is considered to be. I'd like to expand the definition, at least for our purposes of this discussion, because lots of times when people think about bullying, they're thinking about the stuff that they see, the more frankly aggressive situations, a kid getting, cornered or a kid getting pushed against the wall or a fight. But bullying takes place in so many ways that are much more subtle. And I really want to expand the definition here to include really all those acts that people do that are just mean, that just are designed to make somebody else feel worse than they're feeling or feel uncomfortable or self-conscious, because a lot of things that we talk about as being bully really are more those. These are very subtle. They're the things that teachers don't see, that parents don't notice, or they notice, but they think, oh, well, that's what all kids do. And it has a terrible effect on kids, and it's just a terrible phenomenon that's going on.
You know, I think one of the things that you talk a lot about in the book that is so important is this idea that we give those kinds of subtler behaviors a pass, and we often frame it as that's just boys being boys.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's an enormous problem. So much of the stuff that adults will see is just dismissed as boys being boys, or that's kids, or, you know, they'll say, well, yeah, you know, I went through it too as a kid, and hey, I turned up okay. And it's almost considered to be a rite of passage in childhood. And it's really not. It's kids sometimes that are being just destroyed emotionally, but certainly are just made to feel uncomfortable and less than who they are.
Yeah.
And I think
yeah.
There's also a lot of things, I like to call them drive-by bullying, where kids will walk past somebody else and shoot off a comment, not just say loser, and walk right by. You know, it's done in an instant. The person's gone in a moment, and there's nobody to call them out on it, and the kid walks on. And, you know, this stuff like this happens all the time out in the open, but it's not really seen, or, you know, back of the bus sorts of incidents in the locker rooms, places like that.
So it sounds like you're also talking about that there may be a culture of verbal banter that we're looking at as just banter, but that actually is abusive.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
It sounds like you're talking about that there's a culture of verbal banter that actually is abusive.
Absolutely. You know, I sit with families almost every day, and I listen in my practice to them talk to one another. And it's sad to me sometimes, because so often I hear parents and kids talking among themselves very sarcastically. There's a lot of quips. There's a lot of, you know, put downs. And it's all sort of meant either in fun, or it's a joke, or maybe if somebody actually says something nice, they have to then quickly tack on some joke at the end to take away the tension of having said something really nice. And unfortunately, this takes the place of conversation for a lot of families. They don't know how to relate and talk to one another without that sort of undertone of a little bit of aggression or sort of resentment that comes through. And it's very unfortunate, because, I mean, kids really don't like it, and, you know, it doesn't serve any purpose other than to create more resentment. But it's really accepted as, oh, gee, this is the way we talk. And I think in our culture, I mean, it's all over the place. If you think about it, you have TV shows, if you listen to the dialogue, if you, in movies, the dialogue between people, often there's this banter, but then at the end, you know, there's this undercurrent of competitiveness, or somehow somebody's going to come out of it ahead of the other.
Yeah.
And this idea of somebody's got to win is pervasive in our culture, and I think it's a real problem.
So, yes, I agree. Part of what you're saying there, and I think when you talked initially about the definition of bullying, that idea that it's that sort of one up, one down. Somebody's got to come out ahead, and somebody else suffers because of it. So it's...
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, this idea that it's sort of like, you know, both people couldn't win. You know, and so it just creates this climate where someone's always trying to get over on someone else. And, it's almost like in order to survive, you have to be better or do something more than the other person. And I think part of that is just tied to the competitive nature of our culture. I mean, everything is so competitive. You know, we have kids suiting up at 40 years of age to go out and become these, you know, big-time athletes. And, you know, it's compete. It's school. It's compete. In music, it's compete. Now, who knows the most songs, or you know, who knows, you know, who's the first one to hear of this new band? I mean, the competition is everywhere, and it just creates a climate where you start to figure, well, you know, you got to get ahead a little bit.
So it's about winning. It's not about the joy of what they're doing.
Exactly. Right. It really takes away from that.
Let's go back to what you were talking about in regards to family dynamics, because I think there's a very important connection there. When, in your professional experience, does growing up in a dysfunctional family increase bullying behavior in kids? And is that connected to the fact that they are getting bullied more at home?
Well, you know, I think growing up in a dysfunctional family is going to increase the chances, really, of any kind of negative behavior, simply because the role modeling is so poor. So people don't relate in very healthy ways, and they don't relate authentically, and communication is usually not very direct, and people are getting caught up in power games or control battles, and this is what these kids growing up in these families are seeing, and that's what they model their own relationships after. So then they go out, perhaps, and relate to their peers or teachers or even friends in that way. And not only do they learn in terms of the actual behaviors, but there's a lot of values that kids are inculcated with in these situations. So they might come out of a dysfunctional family learning that the best thing to do is to protect yourself, or that being vulnerable is dangerous, or that you should never really trust anyone. And those, to me, are very dangerous things to send kids out in the world with. And these are the kinds of things that a dysfunctional family can pass on to its kids. Usually there's a fair amount of aggression or teasing that goes on in a family that doesn't work well because they're not dealing with conflicts and disagreements in a very direct way. And then that stuff just gets passed down the line. Kid goes to school and, you know, looks for somebody else to pass it down to. In healthy families, these are less. The communication is better, relationships are better, so it's less likely for a kid to come out of that environment feeling a need to put somebody else down.
Mm-hmm. I feel like part of what you're saying there is that a kid growing up in a dysfunctional family is either left with the option of being a victim or continuing to be a victim, or reclaiming a sense of power, which can manifest as then being perpetrator-like.
Exactly,
so if you don't want to be bullied anymore, it's like you become the bully.
Right. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes they look out and see only those two options. They haven't had anything that says, you know what, you don't have to be either of those. You could really be something entirely different. They don't see it. They're not aware of it. And or if they do see it, they don't know how to get there, or it just looks too scary.
Yeah. So in terms of additional family dynamics, do you think that sibling relationships or what kids observe in terms of the parent-child dynamic, does that also play a role in bullying?
The sibling relationships, I think there's so much bullying that goes on and teasing that goes on between siblings. It's actually also a very sad thing for me to see, because so many families will accept this as just the way it is. As if, you know, siblings are hardwired to be at each other and saying mean things to each other and exploiting one another. This happens a lot. You'll have an older brother taking advantage of the fact that a younger sibling looks up to him, and he'll use that to get the kid to go along with his way, go along with his rules, and or an older sister that takes advantage of a younger sister who just idolizes her. And she takes advantage of the kid by getting the kid to do things for her and stuff like that. And, you know, just in a situation like that, I think, wow, what that younger kid would give to have, to get the time of day from this older sibling. Mm-hmm. And instead of that, there's this, you know, back and forth and back and forth. And the one problem I see is that we've set the bar too low in terms of family life, where that's accepted as the norm, like all kids do this. And it doesn't have to be. I don't think siblings really have to fight all the time the way some do. And I think parents need to get in there and intervene, particularly when there is an imbalance of power. And you have one kid who the teasing is incessant and they can't get away from it, or they become sort of the butt of the joke all the time, and they end up feeling really bad and have nowhere to go because, after all, hey, you know what, so-and-so was just teasing. Mm-hmm. You know, an example of that would be, you know, I knew of a boy who came home after a sporting event he had done very, very poorly in. And the older sister came in and saw this and said something to the boy like, oh, hey, nice job today, you know, a quip like that. Mm-hmm. And I was talking with a parent who was wondering, like, what can I say in that situation? And I was saying, maybe you could say to the daughter, with the boy there, something like, you know, he's had a tough enough day, and of all the things that you could choose to say to him, I don't know why you would say that.
Mm-hmm.
And then just leave it there. You're not trying to shame the person. You're not trying to make too big of a deal, but you're just saying, you know, hon, you have choices. You have choices in these situations, and you could choose to make somebody feel worse about themselves, or you could choose to do something different.
And I love what you are highlighting there, Janet, is really trying, and we'll talk more about this a little bit later in the program, but the idea of trying to instill and enhance a greater feeling of empathy.
And
we're going to talk more about that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to stay with the whole cultural view of non-athletic kids and the impact that that has on accepting bullying. So we will be right back after this break, and we will continue. Stay with us.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book, Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe.
And
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com.
Why do people behave the way they do? The study of human behavior is one of the most interesting facets of life. Human behavior gets played out in a limitless number of ways. Now, there's a radio program that explains the why and the how of what we do. Human Behavior, What a Trip, is hosted by Dr. Jonathan Brower and will include interesting guests as well as call interaction from people like you. Let's have fun with this together. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Being here with Ariel and Shia Kane is an ordinary person's guide to modern-day enlightenment. This show is an exciting exploration which opens the door to living in the moment. Don't miss being here. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern with Ariel and Shia Kane right here on the Seventh Wave Network.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferrance or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferrance.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We are talking about the impact that bullying has on children with Dr. Janet Sasson-Edgett. And Janet, I want to talk about, I think, a really fascinating concept that you write about in the book, this term jockocracy. I don't know, did you coin that term?
No, I did not coin it. No, it came from the Urban Dictionary on the Internet.
Okay, great word. And you, I think you write very eloquently about the impact that that has in terms of giving jocks a pass and non-athletes sort of not a pass. And the if you can talk more about the impact that that has on the acceptance of bullying.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, in the United States, there's this cultural aggrandizement of athletes. They're just thought to be, they just put on a pedestal where, you know, if you're big and strong and powerful and have great athletic ability, you know, it's sort of this automatic path to being popular and, you know, socially powerful. And in a sense, that kind of person has become a gold standard for masculinity and being cool. You know, and unfortunately what's lost is recognizing all the other traits that males have that are not based in brawn or aggression or strength, but on, you know, intellectual abilities and interpersonal strengths and other non-physical kinds of things. I remember my my colleague and co-author, Beth Margolis Rupp, said to me while we were writing the book, she said, you know, our society makes kings out of certain boys and they become our standard bearers. And I think that that plays, I think it's very true, and I think it plays a big role in a lot of the second-class citizenship that non-athletic boys are awarded by not only their peer group, but adults as well. There's this mythology that all boys like sports and should play them, and if they don't play them, well, there's something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. And even early on, you know, boys know who runs fast and who doesn't, and who's strong and who doesn't, and there's this division. And some boys do fine with it, and they don't let it affect them, and other boys are very affected by this. But I think, you know, our cultural emphasis on power and strength and competitiveness and so forth just fuels this and makes it very difficult for these non-athletic boys to be recognized for their strengths and be seen as playing on the same field.
And I know that one of your many areas of expertise is in sports psychology. One of the things I've always grappled with when I work with teenagers, you know, therapeutically, is the fact that it seems to me that coaches and even parents are so often condoning what I call motivating through shame or humiliation, thinking that that's a way that you'll get the kid to perform better on the athletic field. Does that also have an impact on, in some implicit way, saying that bullying is okay?
Oh, my gosh, I'm so glad you raised that. That, to me, is just one of the things. It's hard for me to believe that this is still as prevalent as it is. I mean, we've all seen coaches yell at kids, or we hear from kids their experiences. I was involved in show jumping horses for many, many years, and, you know, I would hear around me coaches at different competitions, some of them just berating their riders. It's, you know, no one ever does better by being humiliated.
I'm so glad you're saying that. Let's say that again, because that's something I feel so strongly about too.
Just nobody ever does better under those conditions. And all it does is make somebody more afraid to make a mistake. And so they tighten up, and they're not able to play their best or do their best, whatever it is, whether it's music or an athletic performance. They don't have access to all their abilities because they're so tightened up and worried about making a mistake. Not to mention the fact that having somebody yell at you like that and berate you in public is just, it's horrible. It's a horrible feeling. You get embarrassed. You feel self-conscious. And what does that say about the coach's relationships with athletes? And what's really mind-boggling, Lisa, is the parents that accept it there, not anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah. They buy into some kind of propaganda that this is the way that we can get your kid a full ride to college or get them to the Olympics?
That's right. And you know, I think you had even said before that the more talented that an athlete is, the more likely it is that a parent will look the other way because there's, you know, so much riding on that. And, you know, this promise of a full ride and being an athletic star and all that is just too compelling. And so parents let coaches talk to their kids in ways that they wouldn't let anybody else talk to them.
Yeah, it's a very important point, Janet. You know, I think it's actually worth saying, just a few days ago in the Baltimore paper here, Ray Rice, who is a Baltimore Raven, made a very conscious decision to dedicate all of his resources and his, I guess, his public persona and his fame to raising awareness about bullying. So to me, that feels like, I guess, an important counterpoint that here's an athlete who's so respected and so beloved, certainly in Baltimore, you know, really being willing to take a very public stand about the profound impact that bullying can have on kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Guess and we need more athletes. We need more athletes to do that, I would say.
I think so, too. And I'll tell you, that's one very huge way that we can begin to change this whole bullying, you know, problem, because it's going to be very hard if we continue to get at it by trying to get at it by telling the bullies not to do it and to stop it and to impose consequences and so forth. But if we could, in a sense, take the value out of bullying, it becomes not cool, and have high-profile, well-respected people stand up and say, actually, there's a different way to do things that doesn't involve bullying, we can kind of flip things on its head, because we start to create cultures that value community and working together and generosity. But we need people who kids respect to stand up and say, yeah, I'm all about that. I do that. This is what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, you know, it just, the culture continues where, you know, the bullies get something out of bullying. And until we stop that reward, we're going to have a lot of difficulty shutting, you know, people down who do that.
And I remember in your book you also talk about, and I thought this was really fascinating, and I had not read this perspective before, and I really loved it, that when we look at the consequences that we're giving to bullies, that it's not so much about the punitive stuff. It's more, if I understood it right, it's more about putting them in situations where you're almost forcing them to feel a greater sense of empathy or compassion, sort of trying to flex that empathic muscle in them. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, sure, Lisa. Yeah, I mean, often, you know, bullies get some kind of consequence. Maybe they get an in-school suspension or out-of-school suspension or expulsion or something like that, which doesn't really teach them a whole lot. It protects the person who's been victimized, but the situation is likely to happen again. What I would like to see is the bully or perpetrator have a consequence that involves this bully being placed in an environment where his typical ways of maneuvering people aren't going to work. And the bully is very good at creating environments around him or herself that allow the bullying to continue. So they surround themselves with kids who want to be safe from the kids bullying, so they're not going to comment on it, or other kids who want to, you know, be on the bully's side and so forth. But if you put a kid like that in an environment where bullying is not seen as cool or it's not accepted, it changes. So I think one of the examples I gave in the book was a kid who had made fun of another child who was learning disabled or had some kind of disability, mm-hmm. would be asked to spend a couple of lunch periods working with another group of kids, older kids, who were perhaps making a handicapped ramp for some part of the school, maybe as part of a senior project. And so this kid is now in an environment where the kids around him aren't going to laugh at jokes about kids with disabilities. They're going to look at him, and he's going to feel a little uncomfortable. And they're not going to laugh when he makes a comment about somebody who doesn't do something very well. They're going to look at him and make him feel uncomfortable. And that discomfort, which is not shaming, just mm-hmm. the discomfort, is the type of thing that can begin to change how somebody interacts with their environment. We have to have a different environment around first so that there is this sort of rubbing together of two different worldviews and seeing what happens.
I love that. I really think it's such a brilliant way to address this. And you're putting that bully into a context that is more empathic, and also giving him a reality check that what he's saying is not cool and really not acceptable.
Right. It's a way of saying, you know what, in your world, which is small, that may work, but the larger world is not going to go along with it. And, you know, at the very least, it will be uncomfortable. At the very worst, there will be more severe consequences. But the same thing will happen if you put a kid like this, you know, the consequence being to go and read to a kindergarten class or a class of younger kids who have a speech impediment or a reading disability. That would be the same thing, and it really puts them in contact with people who they begin to see as individuals and not as, oh, that kid that talks funny.
Yeah. So we've been talking about this concept of empathy. What's your professional opinion about why there is such a lack of empathy on the part of bullies?
Well, I have two thoughts about that. One is that I believe in many situations, kids who grow up and are very comfortable with exerting pain or discomfort on other people have experienced a lot of that. Not all the time, by any means. But I think that it would be safe to say that in many cases it hasn't been a strong exposure to acts of genuine kindness and generosity, either in the family or the environment or the people that they're close with. And I don't want to imply that all the time, because some people come out of very, very, very generous and sensitive and considerate families, and they just have a different way of reacting to people. But I think parents can do a lot to begin to bring this out in children, starting very, very, very young in making kids aware of the impact of their behaviors on other kids. I mean, when they're 3, when they're 4, and creating in them a feeling that, you know, being empathic and making somebody else feel good can make you feel good. It doesn't take away from you.
I'm remembering in the book that you even talk about encouraging, you know, young kids not to step on ants or not to, you know, kill bugs, which I think is planting that seed about being more empathic towards life and that creatures and people have feelings.
That's right. They have feelings. And, you know, even at that level, it starts right there. I mean, a parent can intervene. Like, for instance, if you're on a grocery store line and you're behind an elderly couple, they're taking a long time, or a mother with three kids, and, you know, and rather than share a look of exasperation or impatience with your child, you could just stay with them and later on talk with them about what that's like for either the elderly couple or even the single mother who probably is aware that there's people behind them. And what could you do to make it more comfortable for them? Can you say something or make a gesture that says, it's okay, don't worry, I'm okay waiting for you. And it's these little kindnesses in the world that really make a big difference. It's huge. But there was another interesting point I wanted to make about empathy, because there's a clinical psychologist in California. Her name is Dr. Marie Lamia, and she actually is talking about empathy where we're assuming that if somebody is empathic, they're going to do something to help the person feel better. But she's saying that, you know what, just because you empathize with someone doesn't mean you're necessarily going to make them feel better. And that, in fact, people who are bullies or manipulators actually have a lot of empathy if we're understanding empathy to mean the ability to understand or sense another person's feelings. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that they use it to control them or make them feel worse. So they feel they're aware the other person is feeling pain, and that is awful, but they go in further. And I thought that was a very, very interesting concept.
It is. So exploiting that awareness that the other person is vulnerable and has sensitivities.
Right. They go in and exploit it. They have the same information that somebody else does, but they use it very differently.
Yeah. Why do you think certain kids are more vulnerable to being bullied?
I think there are both personality traits, and I think there are also physical traits that will lead some kids to be more vulnerable to being bullied or not. I mean, anything that is different from the norm, so to speak, is a problem. So if, you know, and I would say the farther away you are from this sort of gold standard of the big and powerful, strong, athletically gifted person, the farther away from that, then the more likely you are to have some problems perhaps with bullying. You know, certainly being different in that way, even something like, you know, a mole in the wrong place is enough for kids to be bullied. It's kids who are very self-conscious often are targeted because people find out that they're fun to tease. They are easy to make cry, and that becomes fun for them, which really bothers me, because then we're talking about bullying like as a sport. It's like recreation. And I just hate that whole idea of people, you know, going out and doing this as an element of sport. But kids like that, and then it depends also how kids react. The ones who react most strongly and get the most flustered by it, of course, are also the ones that are more vulnerable. You know, kids who are more anxious, anything like that is going to make it more difficult. Kids with some kind of, you know, psychological diagnosis or struggling in some way, you know, they talk about a lot of kids who are on the spectrum with Asperger's, often because they don't, you know, always get the social cueing that they're often victim to these things, and they don't often like the same activities, so they're marginalized, and you know, that too is just the situation, and just, you know, builds on itself.
And in your experience, are boys bullied differently than girls?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Are boys bullied differently than girls?
Oh, boys being bullied, are boys bullied differently than girls? Yes, I think they are bullied different. I think bullying in boys and girls is different. With boys, it's more overt. It's more frankly aggressive, and it's usually physical in nature. With girls, it's different. It's more covert. It's subtle. It's surreptitious. It's often called relational bullying, because they don't go so much to physically hurt a girl, but they go to hurt a girl by affecting her relationships with other people. So they might be spreading rumors, and doing more things like cyberbullying and so forth. So that's the difference between how boys and girls bully. And I think as far as the impact on kids, I believe that at times for certain boys, it's even a more humiliating experience to be bullied and not be able to stop it because, boys learn that they're supposed to be able to take care of their problems. So they wear a mask over their distress and usually suffer in very private ways without other people knowing about it.
Hmm. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd like us to talk a little bit now about cyberbullying. You brought that up, and the differences, perhaps, between cyberbullying versus face-to-face bullying and the impact that that has on the victim. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Stay connected.
Sign up for our newsletter.
Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferentz, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book, Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferentz's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferentz's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe. And
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferentz's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferentz.com. That's www.lisaferentz.com.
Caring for someone with autism can be full of challenges and triumphs. Wherever you are on your autism journey, we all benefit from good information and guidance. Join host Rob Haupt every week for a friendly show that will leave you inspired and informed. Tune in to Autism Spectrum Radio. Our guests include parents, advocates, and experts to discuss current experiences, treatments, and breakthroughs for those living with autism. Listen every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferentz or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferentz.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We're talking about the impact that bullying has on children. And Janet, I'd love you to address a little bit the issue of cyberbullying versus face-to-face bullying, the differences there, and does that evoke different trauma in kids? I recently read an article that the CDC put out. This was from 2011. They said that 16% of high school kids were cyberbullied. My fear is that that number is probably higher now. But what are you seeing as the differences there?
That's the enemy you can't see and you can't follow, and the sense of helplessness is tremendous with that. I mean, you know, just think about it. If someone's saying things about you, either to your face or indirectly, and you can't stop it, you can't do anything, and it's just a horrible, horrible feeling. You know, the rumors or the comments, it's almost, they become bigger than life. And some kids, even who've been bullied like that and know that it's harmful and it's painful, they just join in. It just, rumors become bigger than life and it goes viral and kids join in and they get on board and, you know, it's something that goes through a whole community within a school or even through a whole school. The thing, you know, not too long ago, bullying was a problem that involved maybe a handful of kids. And it would happen in a place either where nobody saw it or some people saw it, and it would kind of disappear with a visit to the principal's office or parents get called and this and that, and it's handled. But now with the internet and Facebook and texting and all that, I think bullying has a new, it's much higher level of visibility and a much higher level of play. And so it's able to exploit kids much more easily. It's able to exploit kids' naivete about cyberbullying and how the internet could work. And it also exploits their need for acceptance and capitalizes also on the public viewing. So it's like a runaway train. It's just had all, has all these factors in it that are different and make it very powerful and very dangerous and very scary for kids who are caught up in that and have to go to school the next day with this. And it's very different. And the other thing too is that with cyberbullying, you know, of course, you're not usually face to face. So kids say things that they would never say to somebody face to face. It's meaner. It's meant to really, really hurt and leave somebody devastated. And, you know, in face to face bullying, usually things stop a little short of that.
Yeah, I've always felt that cyberbullying was an even more cowardly approach because of the anonymity.
It's cowardly. It is cowardly. You know, but the thing is also, Lisa, I think sometimes, you know, the point of the bullying isn't really to get a message across to somebody about what you think of them. It's to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to hurt them. So, you know, again, it comes into this idea of being recreation almost. It's a game. And it happens in that vein. And to me, that's just so upsetting to see that this is so appealing to so many kids. And that, you know, kids can stop it. It's going to be the people who are the bystanders and people who are listening in on the conversation who are viewing it. These are the people who can stop it because they don't have to tweet it and they don't have to look at it. And they could say something like, you know, not interested in this or knock it off or something. And my hope is that that's where our interventions can go to helping these people speak up and feel more comfortable saying, you know, I really don't want to be part of this.
I'm remembering that in your book, you talked about something that really was fascinating to me, and that's the idea that kids who witness bullying and do nothing may be just as affected, if not more so, than the kid who's actually being bullied. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Kids who have to watch it go on, there many situations they feel they can't say something because, first of all, if they do speak up, even something like, you know, leave them alone, then they become targeted too. It's like, oh, you his friend, and or they become sort of vulnerable to being teased the next day. So they really putting themselves out there. And they don't know if anyone's going to join them. I mean, it's one thing if you know, I'll speak up and then I have 6 or 8 people or even a dozen people here who'll step in too. If you're there by yourself, not so easy to do that. So then they end up with this feeling of guilt sometimes, feeling really bad, especially if the person is their friend and they didn't step up to say anything. And so it impacts that relationship, but they live with that and they suffer with that. I once was working with a boy in middle school who, had become not as popular as he had been, in the year before. And he said to me once, he said, you know what? I realized what the difference is. He goes, I stopped being mean to people. And I think that if I want to be popular again, I have to go back to doing that stuff, and I really don't want to. And I have kids also who tell me that they get so pained watching the bullying going on and knowing that they can't do anything about it. It makes it hard for them to go to school. It makes it hard for them to walk around because at any point you could run into some of this. It's really very difficult on them.
Mm. I also read in a recent article that they were looking at the sort of the long-term psychiatric outcome for both being bullied and being a bully. It was sort of shocking because they had a group of 1,420 kids between the ages of 9 and 16 just in certain counties in North Carolina. That's a huge amount of kids who profess to either bullying or being bullied. And when they looked at some of the outcomes, probably not at all surprising to you, they saw that people who have been victims of bullying or who had been doing the bullying were kids who went on to have a higher prevalence of agoraphobia and generalized anxiety and increased risk of young adult depression, panic disorder, suicidality. What are you seeing in your practice in terms of the long-term impact that being bullied and bullying is having on kids?
Well, you know, you figure if your kid has been bullied and you walk into school every day looking over your shoulder to see if someone's coming, that's an anxiety that just lives in you, it grows in you, and it doesn't go away if you've been living with that for years and years. And sometimes these things become a way that a person adjusts to the world. So that's, you know, so you do have people with anxiety disorders that end up, you know, staying with them for years and years, and if not their life. I see all of that. Kids who are depressed, I see kids who are so crushed. They're afraid to go to school. They're afraid to go because they might cry, and they don't want to cry, and they don't have any friends to as resources there. They try and tell teachers, and teachers aren't really able to do anything. Kids who are lonely, who go through school with very, very few friends. A lot of kids who don't do as well academically because they're distracted by this and they're always worried about where they're going to be. Kids who don't go to the bathroom all day because they're afraid to go to the bathroom by themselves. And so what's the impact of that? I remember when I was writing the book, I was interviewing a lot of men who had been bullied as kids and was asking them the same question, and they were saying that it stays with them. One person gave as an example, he was bullied when he had gone to a friend's birthday party, and the father of this friend decided that they were going to play football, and this poor kid just happened to get the ball and run the wrong way with it, and this father just lit into him. And the boy says to this day, he doesn't ever want to be out in a position where he's taking a chance on something. He said, I always worry that I'm going to catch that ball and still run the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So he's a behind-the-scenes kind of guy. Now, he said, you know, I might have been that way anyway, but that really stayed with him, and I think there are these kinds of impacts. And I know other interviewees, some would say, it's hard for them to join a group of guys as men, you know, because everyone's, let's say, talking about the things that they used to talk about in high school, that this person wouldn't have been able to join in football, you know, scores and this and that. And he says sometimes when he goes to a party and the game is on and everyone's surrounding that, he says, oops, I came too early again. He meant to come after the game. So, you know, these kinds of things really do stay with people. Sometimes people have other adjustments where they just become more withdrawn, and that is with them. Or some kids become class clowns because it's just too hard to walk around being a sitting duck all day. It's almost like rather than me waiting to see if someone's going to pick on me and kids laugh, I'm just going to make it happen. And so they become a class clown, and then that affects their relationships, and they come out of school with some of that perhaps still with them.
Hmm. So, you know, I everything you're saying is, you know, I'm seeing that in my practice as well, so I know how real that is. A question that I get asked, and I want to defer to you because you're much more of the expert in this area than I am, you know, the whole issue of school shootings and how frequently, and suicide, and how frequently when we kind of look back in hindsight, we see that the kid who committed some horrific act and, you know, walked into a school and started shooting, or the kid who told everybody on Facebook he was going to kill himself and did it, that often that was a kid who was bullied. And certainly that would never, you know, that doesn't condone what they're doing. But do you see a connection between things like school shootings and bullying?
Well, you know, there was there's this book by Dr. Peter Langman called Why Kids Kill in the Minds of School Shooters, and he went to investigate this question, and he says it's really not any direct relation between bullying and school shootings. He says the three types of school shooters are really more likely to be psychopaths or psychotic or traumatized, and these are the psychological foundations that can lead somebody to, you know, go and into a school with a gun. But the idea that it's a retaliation for bullying usually is incorrect. And that's, you know, that seems almost counterintuitive, and it's against what a lot of people sort of tend to believe, because in so many cases, these kids were bullied. And I think that they might have, in fact, been bullied because they were different and because there was something about them. So I think there's a relationship, but not a causal one.
Okay.
You know, I think a lot of the shooters have a history of being bullied, but it's not the deciding factor in them going ahead and becoming murderers.
Okay, good. I think that's an important distinction. So in just the minute that we have left, Janet, I want to leave people with on a hopeful, optimistic note. Just very, very quickly, can you just share with us sort of closing remarks about what we can do to empower kids to speak up when bullying occurs and how we can, you know, move forward with this issue?
Yes. You know, the one thing I think we could, if we could just keep it in the front of our minds, is that most kids really, they don't like the bullying either. And most kids really do want a different kind of culture in their schools and a different culture even in their families, ones that are not based on putting other people down. So the resources of people are there, and I think we can see that kids have responded very well to a lot of the anti-bullying movements and programs that are going on. The ones that are really effective, the ones that seem authentic to them and involve them, they're right there with it. So they really do want to make a difference, and I think we can capitalize on their enthusiasm and interest in this and talk to them. I think we need to be talking to kids much more about personal power in social relationships from the time they're very young. I mean, how it's used and not used and how it shows up in the cafeteria, how it shows up in birthday parties or dating and why people want to hold it and how kids, you know, imbue or divest others of it. And the more we talk about it, the harder it's going to be for kids to do their thing again. Because if they start rolling out their, you know, type of bullying or teasing, whatever, people look at it differently because they were just talking about it in class or they were talking about it in an auditorium, at an assembly, or at home. And it can't roll out the same way again when you're doing something and you know that other people are thinking about what you're doing in a different light, even if they may not be saying it. It's a beginning to changing some of the culture so that the bully becomes the outlier.
Excellent.
It makes no sense to do it anymore.
I love that you're focusing on talking about it. And again, one of the great things about your book, The Last Boys Picked, is that you give such wonderful examples of how we can more effectively talk to kids about this issue. Thank you so much, Janet, for your wisdom and for being with us. Next week, I'll be discussing prescription drug abuse with Marsha Lee Taylor. In the meantime, I know you have what it takes, care of yourself. And in closing, I'd like to say that our thoughts and prayers go out to everyone who's been directly and indirectly affected by the horrific act of terrorism at the Boston Marathon. Be well.
Thank you for listening to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. Please join Lisa Ferrance again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. May the next week be a positive, life-changing one for you.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.